From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, how Milwaukee's rising infant mortality rate relates to other public health challenges we face. Later, artist and writer Austin Kleon says there's no shortcut to success in art or anything else.
So many people wait until, oh, I got to know who I am before I can do my work. And so much of what I've learned is that it's really in doing the work that you find out who you are. Work has to be a verb before it's a noun.
And a Milwaukee writer's latest book is a guide to some of the best fantasy novels for both children and adults.
Someone said that fantasy was the original fiction. It used to be all fiction was fantasy and had this mythological impact. And, you know, maybe other fiction has gotten lighter while fantasy has kept its depth.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. Milwaukee's efforts to reduce the rate of infant mortality in the city took a blow yesterday when the city released new data showing the rate climbed to 10.3 deaths for every 1,000 births in the city. That came after consistent decreases in the last decade. Moreover, the mortality rate among African-American babies climbed as well to 15.6 per 1,000, a rate almost threefold higher than white babies. Magda Peck is the dean of the Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. We spoke with her yesterday in an interview taped on the sixth floor of the University Club of Milwaukee. Welcome to Lake Effect.
It's a delight to be here, Mitch, and what a view and what a great moment to be with you.
Let's start with the challenging news about infant mortality in Milwaukee. How outraged, disappointed should we as a community be in the numbers that we're hearing?
Fully outraged. And I am so delighted that you asked the question. Because one of the things that I think happens with old news, and infant mortality feels like old news, is that people take it in and say, yeah, too bad, and they move on. And so if you deconstruct it and not talk about infant mortality, let's talk about what it is, which is the fact that of the 10,000 or so babies born to women who reside in Milwaukee who gave birth in 2013, 117 babies didn't live long enough to blow out their first birthday candle. And that makes an overall rate of 10.5, which is about 10 per 1,000 live births. The fact that we don't acknowledge 117 deaths and don't get outraged about it as being our youngest citizens is remarkable to me.
We had been making gains for some time in doing something about that rate in Milwaukee. From a public health statistical standpoint, was it likely to happen that we would have a setback?
So there's two ways to answer that. It's never a straight line down. And because it's a rare event, when you have small numbers, your rates can go up and down and bounce around because that's what happens. What the city does, which is the right thing to do in analyzing numbers, is that it puts together not just 1 year, but it combines 3 years at a time. And it does something called 3-year rolling averages. And what that basically means is let's clump a couple of years together and then watch a more stable set of numbers and how it changes. It reduces a little bit of the bouncing up and down. So given that we're talking about deaths over a 3-year period and calculating the rate based on that, it is a very disturbing upward trend overall. We are looking at not only an increase overall away from the goal which has been set by the city for 2017 of being 9.4. So the fact that we'd almost got there and then we went fully backwards is very disturbing. What's more disturbing, perhaps, is the rise, particularly among African-American babies' deaths, where the rate was an atrocious 14.6 the last time it was reported, and now it's 15.6. That makes it perhaps one of the highest black infant death rates in the nation for a city.
How do you see the infant mortality issue as emblematic of public health's challenges overall in Milwaukee?
It is one of the leading indicators that tells us how well we're doing as a city. You know, there's an expression, an old African proverb, that when you meet someone in your village, you say, how are the children? If we asked that question in Milwaukee today, how are our children? And we knew that since the last time we asked that question a year ago, over 100 babies died. We would be saying not so well. And it is an indicator used by public health around the world to be able to compare us to other cities, other nations. And so it is one of those vital signs that tell us how well we're doing or not. But because the numbers are relatively small and disproportionately they're happening in among babies that are of babies of color who live in the central city, I'm worried that when we say, how is Milwaukee doing in its health and well-being, we're not thinking that these are our babies. Now, public health has been using measures to be able to track how well a city's doing for a long time. I would say to you that the graduation rates are public health measures. The teen birth rate that is coming down is great news, public health measure. Literacy levels in fourth grade at age 9. Also, the number of people who fall in the river from alcohol-induced drowning. The number of suicides happening on the North Shore. So we can ask ourselves, how are we doing? And this is one of the important numbers we should be tracking. As much as the inflation rate, as much as the unemployment rate, as much as our economic indicators.
If we look at the rise in infant mortality as a failure of some kind in the community, what is it a failure of? Who's failing and what are they failing at? Or what are we failing at?
It's complicated, and that's what makes it really hard. You know, we can't just point a finger to one thing and say, fix this. So it's a cascade of things. Yes, it is about a failure to assure that every woman who conceives is at her healthiest at the point of conception. So it's a failure to ask, how are women before and between pregnancy, not just when she comes into prenatal care? It's a failure when we want to address the question of, was this a planned pregnancy? And we fail to have the hard conversation about family planning because it's a difficult conversation and becomes politicized. It's a failure when we have so many great efforts going on in this town, great projects and programs, but we have failed to connect them together into a full-court strategic press that we all are moving in the exact same direction to get a single goal done. So I think it's a failure not of what our intentions are, because there's a lot of good intentions, but it tends to be a failure of strategy, a failure of collaboration, and a failure of being able to think before and between, not just in the moment. So it's a failure of prevention.
So if there's no easy fix, going back to the idea of the cascade effect and using infant mortality as an example here, how would you say, as a community, we take the first step? What's the first important thing to do in unraveling something as challenging as infant mortality on the rise?
Well, beyond making sure that folks pay attention and take each death as a death of one of our greatest to be, we want to ask the question about not just what to do, but when and with whom. In the work that we're doing nationally in infant mortality prevention, there has been a movement to address preconception health. That's looking at the health of women and men before pregnancy. And there's even a stronger movement to ask, what are we doing between one pregnancy and the next? For the most part, our attention shifts after a baby is born to the baby, which is makes sense, vulnerable. But mom is also vulnerable. So if there was one time in which we could do a full court press is to make sure that from one pregnancy to the next, every woman in this city had access and used optimal health for herself that's not prenatal care or just the postpartum visit, but tended to the things that will help her be at her healthiest the next time around. Specifically, we can help her to be of healthy weight because obesity is related to low birth weight, birth defects, future chronic disease in mom, and obesity in children. We can help work with her and her family to have strong support systems so that every pregnancy is wanted and we're ready. We can work to make sure she has folic acid, an essential nutrient, on board through healthy foods and some supplements so that there's no high chance of birth defects because it's preventable. We could help her to address issues of smoking, issues of drinking, issues of violence in the home. We could help her to be in a stable home, neighborhood, and community. If we paid attention to every woman from the moment she brings that baby home and said, on our watch, we're going to give safe passage to the next pregnancy, that could be a strategy. If there was one other, it's to recognize that so much is already being done to address infant mortality. The Life Course Initiative for Healthy Families, which is being led now in Milwaukee through the United Way, or the work that's happening in Pearls for Teen Girls that's addressing the greatness that girls have to give them safe passage to adulthood. These are fabulous initiatives. If we inventory and connect to have a better systems approach, more efficient, more effective, if we collaborate together and build on what already is working.
If there are all these things that are already working, maybe this is an indelicate question. Are they just not working well enough? I mean, because clearly something went wrong in the last couple of years.
Some things are working, but what we've been timid about is addressing what in that cascade, what drives some of the underlying conditions that can lead to infant mortality. What we haven't really paid attention to, what the science is catching up on, is the impact of stress, and particularly what's called toxic stress. Now, if I have a bad day at work and I'm stressed out, that actually is kind of good stress. My body knows how to respond to that. I give it a little breather and it can get better. But if you live in generation after generation in poverty, when there's no hope for jobs, when violence is endemic on the playgrounds of Milwaukee, when single parenting puts women alone at too young age trying to raise kids when they were not necessarily empowered well as their own. This notion of taking on the rough stuff, the tough stuff, is what is not yet working. The economic downturn over the last 5 years may be biting us in the butt right now in this uptick of infant mortality, the chronic stress that's come from those that were already vulnerable, left with so much less, that the stress that a pregnant woman endures before and during her pregnancy may be leading to the number one driver clinically of babies dying, and that's babies being born too small, too soon. 65% of the babies who die in the first year of life are born too small. They're premature. That prematurity may be being triggered in some by this chronic stress that comes from the underlying social and economic conditions. We get at that as a city, we prosper as a region. We get at that as a city, and we'll have babies that blow out their first birthday candle.
The School of Public Health itself is no longer a newborn. Maybe it's more like a toddler at this point. What would you say have been the victories for the School of Public Health in its young history?
I'd say our first victories is graduating students who are emerging leaders for the public's health and well-being, that know how to think systems change, that know how to bring people together, that translate the numbers and the data into action, that are out there for a new workforce. And we now have 14 graduates that are mostly from the Milwaukee area and most staying in the Milwaukee area. So that's a small victory in changing the workforce. The second is that we've been able to recruit mostly faculty that have come from all over the country. We call them the best and brightest to come and live and be part of Milwaukee's vitality. They're bringing their children. They're setting up shop here for the next part of their career. And they're bringing their ability to think about health equity, social and environmental determinants of health, and to do the kind of collaborative research we'll get at those harder, tougher drivers of health beyond the immediate program. So scientists and researchers who are going to be putting Milwaukee on the map in partnership with folks who have been doing this a long time to get at the larger social and environmental drivers of who lives and who dies. And if there's a third, I love that Joe Zilber built us a cool building in the brewery. I think it's the hottest, newest neighborhood in town, but it's also on the tail end of 53205. We're part of community, not on the main campus of UWM. We're part of the central city on the edge of the most prosperous parts of our community. This building has become what I call a do tank, not just a think tank.
Magda Peck, thank you so much, and happy birthday.
Hey, thanks. Turning 60 looks really great. Thanks, Mitch.
Magda Peck is the founding dean of the Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. Our interview was recorded yesterday before an audience at the University Club of Milwaukee. Keep listening. Next on the program, a self-help guide for artists, how to better share their creativity with the world. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Austin Kleon has made newspaper censorship fun. Well, it's not really censorship, but here's how he describes what he does.
I make boxes around words that pop up at me, and I usually try to arrange those words into a little funny phrase or a saying, and then I black out everything I don't need. It sort of looks like if the CIA did haiku.
Kleon still does these newspaper blackout poems each day, but he's also expanded his reach with the best-selling book Steal Like an Artist and his newest Show Your Work, 10 Ways to Share Your Creativity and Get Discovered. Kleon tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North that the prescriptions he sets out are really pretty simple.
Anyone can do it, but it takes a lot of effort. You know, there's a lot of work. That's something that I always try to emphasize and whenever I'm talking to aspiring anybody's really is just the enormous amount of work there is, you know, in front of you if you want to make yourself successful. I think a lot of times people say, you know, they think the inspiration is the problem or getting the good idea is the problem. I'm like, no, it's the execution. You know, there's so much work involved.
What is that wonderful quote? It's 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration.
I think that's Edison. I think it's Thomas Edison, but I'm not totally sure. But yeah, it's 99% perspiration. So, you know, what I'm interested in is just how can you turn what you do into a daily practice, something where you just show up every day in the same spot, the same time, and you do the work, you know, because I think that's the only way that, you know, in my career I've been able to do it, you know, not a sprint but a marathon, you know, just how do you build that long-term approach to your work?
Well, you're dealing with a culture, though, that wants instant gratification.
Yes. I don't know if you saw the documentary 20 Feet from Stardom. It's a documentary about backup singers, famous backup singers like Darlene Love, who actually did do her own solo career with Phil Spector. But, you know, just how hard it is to go from being a backup singer to the main stage. But of all people, Sting, as in Sting, the bass player, lead singer in the Police, Sting, he had my favorite quote in there. And he said, there's a lot of spiritual work that's to be done in art. And he said, you know, these American Idol shows, if you jump on these shows, you bypass all that work and that slow build towards your craft and your career. And I don't think it's very healthy. You know, I don't think overnight success is very good for anybody because it fizzles out eventually.
And then you have nothing to fall back on.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at a lot of child actors, you know, there are very few child actors that are able to actually turn that early success into a long-term career, you know. But there are those that do.
Like Jodie Foster.
Right. Yeah. And most of them, it's about taking that early success and actually doing the work then, you know, dedicating yourself to that craft and having that long-term approach.
Well, you set out 10 basic things to follow in your book, Show Your Work. And the first one that I love is you don't have to be a genius.
Yeah. So many times when we think about creativity or innovation, we think about, you know, these great ideas. And our culture gets propelled forward by these lone geniuses, right? These people working in solitude that are just superhumanly talented. You know, people with names like Mozart, Picasso, Steve Jobs. They're usually old, dead white men, you know. And, you know, they put their stuff out there and they change the world, right? Well, you know, if you go through history and you look at a lot of these characters, none of them were operating in isolation. You know, a lot of times they were part of a community of thinkers, a whole kind of ecology of talent. Brian Eno has a name for this, the music producer Brian Eno. He calls it senius, not genius. So many of the great innovations and creative leaps in our culture are the result of a senius. So sure, you have Picasso, but you also have Paris in the 1920s. Sure, you have a band like the Talking Heads, but you also have 1970s New York and CBGBs and all that stuff. So the whole point about not being a genius is that, you know, actually, if you want your work to go out in the world and have an impact, you need to think about a senius, how to join a community of people out there and how to be a connector more as, you know, just being this lone genius. You know?
Well, and also the other thing, it's a few more spaces down on the list, but not to be human spam.
Right.
And describe what you mean by being human spam.
So you've met human spam. They're the people at work that, you know, they want to tell you their ideas, but they don't want to hear yours. You know, these are the people that, you know, if you're a musician, they're your buddies that want you to come to their show, but they never show up to your gig. You know, these are the people that want to just kind of flood the seniors with their own junk, but they don't really give anything back in return. You know, I think there are two mythical creatures that will ruin a good community or seniors. On one end is the human spam. On the other end is a vampire. Now, vampires, they just want to suck all the energy from the seniors. You know, they're the people that just take and take and take. And then the human spammers are the ones that just want to flood the seniors with their own junk, you know. And so you have these two, like, mythical creatures. And then the rest of us, you know, we have to find a comfortable spot in the middle. And that's what I think is a contributor. That's someone who takes a little bit from the seniors but also gives something back. You know, and there's that healthy kind of good citizen of a community, you know. And if you can think about your creativity in those terms, I think it'll just get you way further because, you know, if you want to have fans, you have to be a fan first. If you want to get noticed, you have to notice.
Why is it important to show your work? I mean, most of us are afraid of it. It's like it's young and it's delicate and it might get hurt.
Yeah. Well, you know, this was the big leap I made is that, you know, you know, we all have access to our own media now. You know, we can all have our own website. We have our own Twitter feeds, you know, our Instagram accounts, whatever. Really, the making a connection with other people, we have that ability. And so what I realized when I started writing this book is when I was thinking about self-promotion, so many of the people I look up to, they don't worry about self-promotion. They just worry about sharing. And so many of the artists and creative types, but also lawyers that I've fallen into online, my agent, for instance, they share their process. They share all the behind-the-scenes stuff. You know, if you think of it in terms of movies, you know, normally you save the blooper reel and the director's commentary and all the deleted scenes for the end, for the DVD, right? But this way of working, Show Your Work, is like you put all that stuff out while you're making the movie, and then people get fascinated, and then they're ready to go see the movie when it comes out, you know?
Kind of knowing that little bit of interesting background.
Yeah, and it's not about oversharing, you know, because that's one of the things that I think people get confused by. It's not oversharing. It's every day looking back at your process and saying, what's some little piece that I can show people that would either be helpful to them or interesting? And if you can just look back on the day's work and say, what's helpful or interesting that I could share with other people? And you do that every day. You know, those little bits and pieces of effort over time, they turn into something big.
One of the things I was thinking of as I was reading the book is that as you say, we all kind of take care of our own brand, as it were. You know, we have the means electronically, whether it's a website or a Facebook page or whatever it is. How do we know what to pay attention to? We're flooded by so much. You know, just everybody thinking about the interesting, fun thing that day. How do we manage to kind of sift through all of that and still have time for our own work?
I think it's all a matter of scheduling. People get so disappointed when I say this, but it's like everything's time management, you know, like because I'm supposed to be this creative guy. I go out to the woods and I get really inspired. You know, no, it's like I schedule time for everything. So I've got time to do the work, you know, to actually sit down and draw or write or whatever. And then I've got scheduled time to do the sharing or to be on Pinterest or to be on Twitter or something, you know. So make sure you have your time scheduled for the work and you get your work done first. And then schedule 30 minutes to go online and bomb your brain with inspiration and tweet things out and whatever. And then when the timer goes off, 30 minutes up, you get off and you go back to work, you know, and you just be very rigid with yourself. Because one of the things I've noticed is if you schedule time for things, then when you're in that time zone, then you can be really free.
Talk a little bit about flow and stock, because that, I think, is probably one of the key points of this book.
Yeah. So my friend Robin Sloan, he's a novelist, and Robin took this theory from economics, stock and flow. He uses it in terms of media. So what Robin says is that your flow is your day-to-day output. It's like your tweets or your blog posts or your little, you know, just your daily chattering. The stock is the stuff that lasts. It's the bigger pieces. It's like the big project that you finish for a client, or it's a book, or it's a film, or, you know, something that lasts that people will find over time. And so what Robin says is the trick is to keep your flow going while you're working on your stock. But one of the things that I kind of modified his idea, and what I do a lot in my work, is I turn my flow into stock. So what that means is so many of the chapters in my books, they start as tweets, little ideas that I tweet out there, and then people tweet back at me and give me new ideas. And I say, oh, I got to turn this into a blog post. And then I turn it into a blog post, and then people respond to that. And then pretty soon it becomes a tag on my blog, right? And then it becomes a book chapter. You know, so it's that idea of just putting these little bits and pieces out into the world, seeing how people respond to them, and then collecting them into something bigger.
What chapter?
Well, the chapter that really talks about it, share something small every day, this gets a little meta, but that's where that whole idea originated from. If you just do these little bits and pieces and then you collect them over time, it turns into something big.
You've got a body of work, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's again, going back to that kind of marathon approach, is that, you know, to get a body of work, it's not like you have to do all this work right now. You just have to do a lot of work over time and it stacks up. You just have to give yourself a while.
Yes, we have to be patient and actually have the time.
Yeah.
You know, or give ourselves the time to do it. And again, I go back to, you know, we're in a culture that doesn't really reward that.
Yeah.
You know, we're in this kind of instant gratification culture where we want to be famous now.
What's interesting to me is that so many of the overnight success stories, there's about 10 years of work behind it. Like Justin Bieber looks like an overnight success to everyone. But if you go on YouTube, there's pictures of him when he's like 10 years old playing a guitar. You know, like the kid's been playing music since he crawled out almost, it seems like. You know, so I think one of my missions is always to demystify creativity, to show people that behind the scenes, to say, hey, these people that you think of as these mythical creatures that have, you know, just they arrive fully formed. That's just not the case a lot of times. Sure, people are really talented, but there's a lot of work that goes into what you see.
I don't think anyone really comes fully formed.
No.
I really don't. I think that's a myth that we tell ourselves for some reason. I'm not sure why we feel a need to tell ourselves that.
I think it's marketing. You know, I think, honestly, if you're trying to sell artwork or you're trying to sell someone, a lot of times, it's like, well, this is this special person. You know, this person's an alien. You'll never get anything like this. This person's special. And, like, you got to go see them, you know? And it's like, I don't know what it is about mythology. People love origin stories, too, you know? But that's something I try to talk about in my work, too, is that the stories you tell about your work have a huge impact on how people feel about it and how people respond to it. You know, a lot of artists, they kind of cross their arms and they say, the work speaks for itself. My work speaks for itself, you know, and that's just not been my experience at all. I think that what you say about your work has a huge impact on what people think about it.
Or what you don't say, what you leave out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, what you omit can be just as, you know, important as what you tell, as any good storyteller knows.
Right. And that was another thing that you taught, another chapter is tell good stories. Learn how to recognize them and how to tell them.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, I'm not a natural storyteller. My mother is. My mother's a natural storyteller. For me, it's always come a little bit harder. But one of the things I realized is that you just have to be a student before you can be a master. And if you spend a lot of time thinking about stories and what a story is and you pay attention to stories, then you can start collecting them and then you just start filling them in with your own stuff. And so pretty soon you can start telling your own. You know, it's just like if you learn how to draw, you copy other drawings until you have the skills, and then you can start doing your own.
It sounds like it's doing the work that matters.
Yeah. So many people, again, they focus on the inspiration. Oh, if I could just get the right idea, you know, I could write a great book, or I could make a great painting, or I could have a great business. And so many people wait until, oh, I got to know who I am before I can do my work. And so much of what I've learned is that it's really in doing the work that you find out who you are. Work has to be a verb before it's a noun. You know, so like before you have a painting, you have to paint. And so everybody wants to have the noun without the verb. And so I'm always telling people, if you can forget about the noun, forget about the job title, forget about being an artist, forget about being a writer, forget about being a plumber or whatever, you know, think about the verb. Think about what you have to do to get there. And so if that's write or paint or plumb or learn, you got to do the verb before you get the noun. And the more you can focus on the verb and doing the verb, just the better off you're going to be. Do the work.
Do the work. Show up and show the work.
Yep.
So, Austin Kleon, I am so glad that you are showing your work and that you came in to talk to us about it. It's been such a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure's been mine. Thank you.
Austin Kleon's newest book is called Show Your Work, 10 Ways to Share Your Creativity and Get Discovered. Kleon, who coincidentally lives in Austin, was in Milwaukee recently on a book tour, and he spoke with Bonnie North. A new book by a Milwaukee writer offers a guide to remarkable and timeless fantasy novels for children and adults. We'll hear about some of them when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Every year, awards like the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award honor what many people think of as serious fiction. Weighty titles wrestling with weighty issues in a way that's sometimes accessible, sometimes less so. It's rare to find fantasy titles falling in the category of those so honored, but Milwaukee writer Philip Martin would urge you not to overlook the genre or think of it as frivolous. Martin's recent book is called The Purpose of Fantasy, a reader's guide to 12 selected books with good values and spiritual depth, and he's with us to talk about some of those books. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mitch.
The title of the book is The Purpose of Fantasy. Let me take a riff off of that title and ask you what the purpose of this book is. What are you hoping to accomplish? Who are you hoping to reach?
The working title for the book was actually something like 12 fantasy books to read that will make you a better person. It's really kind of a self-help kind of concept of fantasy. And then I thought, oh, that's a little too self-help. And actually, the people who I think will enjoy this are people who already love fantasy. So, you know, they don't need the help. I was just trying to be more encouraging people to see fantasy as kind of more from a serious light or practical light, that actually fantasy isn't escapist, but it's actually very useful. It's a way of creatively dealing with real problems that you can apply to your life. And, you know, it's good for families, it's good for kids, it's good for old folks. It's, you know, really something that's often looked down on, I felt.
Complaint that some have is that it is removed from the real world and so it doesn't deal with real world issues. And you kind of confront that in this book.
That's exactly what got me to write this is there was recently a study that showed how much kids love to read fantasy. You know, there's a huge predominance over other types of books like, you know, mysteries and action adventure. You know, they love fantasy. And then kind of the predictable reportage on that was that, well, of course, because, you know, we're living in a scary world and kids naturally want to escape.
I think you make the point in here that fantasy is wonderful in the strictest sense of the word, like full of wonder.
Full of wonder. And that is, in a sense, kind of an ability. It's a creative – some have described it as like it's a kind of muscle of the heart or the soul, something – the more you exercise it, the more capacity you have for it. And so there were a lot of people who were interested in spiritual ideas. C.S. Lewis, who saw fantasy as a way to develop people's powers of imagination and wonder in the sense of really awe and amazement in a way that would help them be more appreciative of the real world and how amazing it is too. Chesterton said in the fairy tale, the apple is golden. And when you come back, you realize how amazing it is that apples grow on trees and they're green and the rivers run with beautiful waters and that's amazing too.
What are you getting at when you talk about spiritual depth? I mean, is this the idea that especially for the 12 titles that you feature, are they grappling with bigger questions than just good versus evil?
Yeah, their fantasy can be used to really address all sorts of issues or ideas. I started with a couple of books. There was one called Momo and another called Tuck Everlasting. Tuck Everlasting talks about the idea of what if you could be immortal? There's a spring in the woods that if you know you drank from it, you would become immortal. And it has this group of kind of backwoods folks, a family called the Tuck family. Unlike the vampires of today who are immortal and just, you know, ultra cool and sophisticated. And Tucks are kind of backwoods and they're just kind of stuck in being immortal.
Like backwoods ennui.
Yeah, and they, you know, their life just repeats. And at some point they say, you know, we're like rocks on the side of the road. Life is going by and here we sit. And so this author, Natalie Babbitt, who's, you know, won many major awards for literature, used this story to talk about the idea of, you know, what if you could? And so the protagonist in the story has to decide, does she want to drink from the spring? And so she makes a, you know, decision by the end of the book. So that's kind of a limit. It's not, you wouldn't call that good and evil, but it's exploring an intangible issue and making it very tangible in this book.
You also mentioned Momo, and I was hoping we could touch on that because it seems like the issue at the heart of it is kind of subtle, actually. It deals – and this is by an author who had a much better known book, the author of the Neverending Story, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, he's dealing with the use of time.
It deals with a lot of things, the use of time, everyday life, and how we use it. And it's a wonderful story of a young mysterious girl, kind of a Pippi Longstocking type. She lives on her own, just is a wonderful person. And her wondrous talent is listening, you know, which is magical in the way she does it. A very simple concept. But these folks, the gray men come to town and they offer to help people become more efficient. And the concept is they'll save all this time. And the gray men offered to bank it for them. And so they quickly turn the town into a bunch of hardworking people who no longer have any fun. They no longer have any art. They have no games. And so it's the children who look at this and try to figure out what to do about it. You know, there's kind of a Buddhist element to the story of every time and daily life and how we disconnect them or measure them in ways instead of just being here now. It's an amazing book, one very little known or read in the U.S. It's available in English translation.
And the author is?
Michael Ende.
Yeah.
There's a new book, new English American version out, and I said at some point I think I might have written this book just to get people to read Momo.
You wrote that you had thought at one point of including Winnie the Pooh in this book, but abandoned that idea in favor of one from a series featuring the Moomin Trolls, and the book you spotlight is Finn Family Moomin Troll, which I will concede is currently being read in the Tyke household at this very moment. And it's I will just by way of a preface say they are a unique group of creatures.
They're weird.
That's you know, a Winnie better the, way to put it.
Yeah. Winnie the Pooh and his friends are kind of blithe, jaunty, free-spirited types, but it's all kind of mild-mannered, pleasant adventures, very Edwardian England kind of stuff. And the Moomin Trolls, you know, it's kind of an acquired taste. A lot of people haven't read those, but almost everyone who's read them really loves the stories. And it just occurred to me I wanted to do Winnie the Pooh, and then I thought, oh, Moomin Trolls are so much better because they're so much more reflective of the human condition in a kind of a richer, you know, both light and dark and just inclusive of all types of really odd wonderfully odd character. I mean, they're just eccentric, but they're all very loving in their way, and they're all embraced in the central family, the Moomin Troll family. And they're wonderful stories, more magical, more mundane than Winnie the Pooh, but highly recommended.
The adventures are of maybe a more modest sense, and what really shows through is the eccentricities of the characters, but only, you know, the as you say, They're all really accepted by each other.
And, you know, interspersed with episodes of real magic. And it's a delightful group of stories. I recommend Moomin Trolls highly.
I imagine a lot of people look at the list of 12 books you feature and they say, wait a minute, where is Harry Potter? Why is Harry Potter or any of the books in that series not included in your list?
Where is Harry Potter? You know, I've, of course, considered it, and I sort of passed on some of the big blockbuster, big series. The Lord of the Rings isn't here, but the thoughts that went into those books are here. I think I tended to pick briefer books that would be easier to pick up and read and, you know, be done with them. They happened to be three-quarters of them are children's books, but I didn't intend that. I was just looking for the best books that you could read to get this sense of the spiritual depth of fantasy. And then when you read Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings, you will see those elements in there. But they're often more hidden with all this action and activity that goes in the big stories.
But you are not necessarily steering people away from Lord of the Rings or from Harry Potter.
No, not at all. It's more just these are more kind of entryway drugs to make you realize why fantasy is chosen by all these amazing authors. I mean, these are some of the top authors in the world. Many of them wrote adult books that were highly regarded. So it's not just an off subgenre of easy to write fiction. Someone said that fantasy was the original fiction. It used to be all fiction was fantasy and had this mythological impact and significance. And, you know, maybe other fiction has gotten lighter while fantasy has kept its depth, is one way to say it.
Philip Martin, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Milwaukee writer Philip Martin's recent book is called The Purpose of Fantasy, A Reader's Guide to 12 Selected Books with Good Values and Spiritual Depth, published by Crispin Books. Our interview first aired in March. Advocates in the local food, the so-called farm-to-table movement, were jolted by a recent op-ed in a national newspaper. Count Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherrick among them.
I have, as of late, lost all my mirth. Hamlet, the soul-searching 20-something, uttered to his school buddies Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Everybody hits a wall as they grow up. It's a necessary pain. We all must hit it nonetheless if we are to keep growing. What we thought we knew to be true and real and certain about the world often turns out to be idealism. We must hit the wall, and the ground beneath us must become unsteady so that you can get your sea legs in life and go on walking with a new sense of equilibrium. Dan Barber, James Beard awarded chef, sustainability stalwart, and TED Talk darling, slammed me, headlong into the reality wall with his recent May 17th column in the New York Times titled, What Farm to Table Got Wrong. By his third paragraph, I was reeling when he says how the farm-to-table movement has scarcely reworked the economic and political forces that dictate how our food is grown and raised. Big food is getting bigger, not smaller, unquote. Terms like farm-to-table and locavore and even foodie have risen like so many centurion shields marching across the land stolen by Big Ag. Our gold standards, all pun intended, of fresh, seasonal, regional, and organic, glinting across the menus and the minds of the public. Yet, according to Barber, we've lost 100,000 farms in the last 5 years, and 1.1% of farms in the United States account for nearly 45% of farm revenues. The majority of that 45% raise corn and soy, both of which are fetishized and subsidized to an extent that would make the Kardashians also unnecessary and closely aligned with the artificial blush. Corn alone is so subversively integrated into the American diet that it is represented by well over 50 pseudonyms on processed food ingredient lists. Fed Up, the film I saw a few nights after reading Barbara's article, delivered a second blow. If you live in America and eat, it is the most important piece of cinema you should see this year. It draws a parallel between the ascent of preventable disease and our biggest food companies with their 600,000 products lining our grocery shelves, 80% of which contain abundant and often unlisted amounts of sugar. When talking about our biggest companies, I call them our because they are. We made them, and we can unmake them meal by meal. Diabetes is the precursor. A generation dying earlier than the previous is the coda. We live in an America where our Secretary of Agriculture demurs on camera when questioned about why tomato sauce has been classified as a vegetable for American children's school lunches. We live in an America where our First Lady has planted the White House garden, which Eleanor Roosevelt was denied, yet simultaneously tells kids to run around more instead of eschewing the sugar and corn-laden metabolic time bombs, which abound, so often labeled fat-free. We live in an America where a fast food chain can and will sell you a dinner of cheap chicken protein paired with a half gallon of soda containing 56 spoonfuls of sugar, all with the promise that they will graciously donate $1 to diabetes research. In the face of all of this, as a foodie and a public one, I felt insignificant and effete. I am looked to as a credible resource for Better Foodways. Fans of the show tell me they make pilgrimages to each location featured on an episode. The farm-to-table trend has grabbed us by the collar and culturally kissed us hard, and we as a community have kissed back. How could nothing have come of all of the CSAs, enlightened chefs, and urban agriculture? Are all these farmers markets and regional dishes just for show? Yes. Definitely. And a fine show we should make of it. As I sloughed off my nausea and came to, clarity came as well. What I do as a foodie with a television show is tell stories about food, which help people elevate their consciousness, and so that, together, we can heal the planet and ourselves along the way. This is only the beginning of the change. The story of our nation's food systems is centuries old, and this one can still be mended. Big tobacco is not unlike big food and once seemed invincible, ensconced in lawmakers' hearts by way of campaign contributions and powerful lobbyists, but is now significantly diminished upon national sentiment. Smoke-free? Inconceivable, my parents' generation said. Even doctors smoke. And now we face our next Goliath, big food. There is an app we can use when we shop which scans product barcodes and alerts consumers to the presence of GMO foods. FoodPolicyAction.org rates elected officials on their actual for-the-people legislation regarding what we eat and have access to. Monsanto is now aware of us and we of them. The politics of food is lapping on the edge of the mainstream. Yes, let's make it a fine show. Every episode I film, every victory garden we plant, every tweet I post, every petition you sign. Every time an elected someone feels the heat of their job security based on how he or she votes on food policy, this is the show we should make of it, and it needs all the fervor and pomp of a ticker tape parade. I have as of late lost all my mirth, but wherefore I know not, Hamlet continued. My where is the soil in my plate, the what my tax dollars and health, and the why is heir apparent.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is host of the public television show Wisconsin Foodie. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, when there are violent acts like the stabbing in Waukesha or the recent mass shooting in California, what are the media's ethical responsibilities? Plus, we'll have a summer books preview for you. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh Air is next, followed by Here and Now at noon.